Mrajuhtuden.
Mrajuhtuden.
Welcome to the Anonymous Eskimo Project, a program where I have candid conversations with guests about difficult but important Indigenous topics such as mental health, sobriety, recovery, and missing and murdered Indigenous people. These difficult topics need to be brought to the light, not only to educate, but to uplift our Indigenous relatives. Oyana for joining me. I'm your host, Ralph Sara. On this episode, I have Roberta Aluk. Roberta is one half Woodlands Cree from Wabaska, Alberta, on her father's side, and one half Dene Sunklene from Dillon, Saskatchewan, on her mother's side. Roberta is currently a University of Alberta student. She is an Indigenous model, and she owns her own beading business. Roberta has 5 years of sobriety, and on this episode, Roberta courageously shares her story for those still struggling. So guys, please help me welcome Roberta Aluk. Hi, Roberta. How are you?
Hey, Ralph. I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing good. It's kind of a balmy Sunday here in Alaska. How is it down there in Alberta or Edmonton?
Yeah, here in Edmonton, it's actually pretty sunny out today. Nice and warm.
Oh, man. I saw you were on a motorcycle ride yesterday. It was a addiction awareness motorcycle ride. How did that go?
Yeah, here in Edmonton, there's quite a few people that ride motorbikes. And I just started this year. And I got in touch with a few other Native people who also ride motorcycles. And my friend that I made, his name's Darwin, he runs an addiction awareness ride once a year, so annually. And yeah, we just rode out to three different locations. I actually only rode to one location, but yeah, they rode out towards Musquechies, Pigeon Lake, and the last stop was somewhere... oh, shoot, I forget where they had ended. But they stop around areas here around Edmonton, and then it's just to raise awareness for addiction. And, yeah, there's, like, I think there was maybe 14 or 16 of us that went on the ride, just kind of all convoying it together on the highway.
Wow, I love those rides.
Yeah.
Roberta, can you go ahead and introduce yourself so our listeners can get to know you?
Yes. so hello, everybody. Tanse. Kia ora, miigwetch, kakiau. I welcome you all. My name is Roberta Aluk, and I'm from Wabaska, Alberta, on my late father's side, and that's Woodlands Cree territory. And I'm from Dillon, Saskatchewan, on my late mom's side, and that's Dene Sunklene territory. And yeah, I'm 26 years old. I have 5 years sobriety, and I'm currently a university student. I'm a model. I have a little beading business, and I do all sorts of things in the community.
And I saw you kind of call yourself an urban native too on your Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm totally an urban native, but I do like the bush life, but I prefer to be in the city.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I moved from a smaller town here in Alaska where you have to either fly in or, you know, there's barges and stuff that come, but there's no roads. But I moved to Anchorage, the biggest city.
Oh, okay. So it's kind of like you're kind of a city person too then.
Yeah, yeah,
nice.
I became a city person.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the University of Alberta. You recently spoke there at a welcoming event where they created an alcohol-free zone. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, so every year, and I'm sure all different kinds of universities and colleges, they all have a welcoming week for students, for staff. And typically at these events, there's beer gardens, so everyone's drinking, having a good time. But then there are a few of us who don't celebrate with alcohol or substance use. And so what the U of A did here in Edmonton, they decided to have an alcohol-free zone, and they had a designated area. It was an event that was really well coordinated. There were a few speakers there. I was one of them to talk about my sobriety and all the wonderful things that I have because of sobriety, and also just who I am. And other than that, they had performers. There was drag performance even, and there was some live music. They had really cheap food that you could buy, and they had drinks there too, like mocktails and pop and everything like that. It was just so amazing to have that at Welcoming Week.
Man, so cool. And usually when you think about get-togethers and stuff like that at universities, you think about, you know, drinking and whatnot. At least when I went to college, that was kind of a big a drinking culture within, you know, the students and stuff like that.
Yeah, it totally is. Everyone's partying, and we're all 21, you know, or younger than that, or in that age range. And, you know, so it was cool to have something totally opposite from the party scene.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And you mentioned you're an Indigenous model. Can you tell us what it's like to be an Indigenous model in this time?
Well, I feel like growing up, I didn't really see a lot of Indigenous representation, like just on TV shows, magazines, you know, what's out there on the media and stuff like that, or what's being talked about. And just lack of Indigenous representation. And nowadays, I feel like you see a lot more of that. We have Ashley Cullimble, we have a new TV series that everyone's into, Reservation Dogs. TikTok's such a big thing too, like native TikTok's a big thing, and suddenly people are really interested in Indigenous representation. So I feel like it's a little more different. For myself, it's very empowering because I don't know, I just never thought, oh, I'm going to be a model one day. And suddenly I am. And I really feel empowered. I feel like me as an Indigenous model, like I sort of have a responsibility to make my family proud, my community proud, and to also talk about First Nations issues and overcoming a lot of adversity and stuff like that. So that's mainly what I do with my modeling. And I just really love it.
Like a platform.
Yeah, something like that, a platform. And most of my work too, it's a volunteer basis. I've been paid a few times, but I mostly do it just to, you know, like put my voice out there in a way. And I volunteer my time a lot. And I specifically like to work, everyone's different. Me, I specifically like to work with First Nations or Indigenous designers, makeup artists, hairstylists, Indigenous photographers, organizations, and events. That's kind of my niche as a model, First Nations model.
Very cool. I saw some of the pictures that Cole took, and man, blown me away. Holy cow.
I know. His platform to it totally blew up. You know, he just started that last year, Indigenality Photography, and it just blew up.
Yeah.
It blew up, and yeah, it's pretty awesome.
One of the singer in my band, his wife is a photographer, and she's the one that recommended Cole to be on my show.
Yeah.
And now they're like talking, I guess, back and forth, and they came up with a very cool idea to swap like regalia, you know, like people from your area wearing regalia from our, and then you know, and vice versa. That would be so cool, wouldn't it?
Yes, that would be cool. Yeah, just to do.
We'll get you in a atguk or something.
Oh, that would be cool. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Wow. So, to get back into kind of the things here, I saw you recently post that you are a first generation survivor of Indian residential school. Mm-hmm. You know, the topic of intergenerational trauma hasn't really been talked about until just recently. And these intergenerational traumas have affected our people for so long, and the shame of what we went through and what our generations before went through was so much, we kept it in for so long, you know. Mm-hmm. And that kind of led to unhealthy ways of trying to cope and deal with it. And a lot of the alcohol use and drug addiction, you know, to mask that pain. I think in order for Indigenous people to break that cycle and to start to heal, we need to talk freely about all the trauma that have that generations have went through, and you know what we went through.
Yeah.
Can you share your personal experiences with intergenerational trauma and the ways you are healing and breaking the cycle?
Yeah, for sure. That term, intergenerational trauma, that is like a fairly recent term. I think it was in the 60s and 50s that a lot of First Nations leaders across Canada, they were protesting, they were having gatherings with politicians like from dominant culture here in Canada. And then what was it in the early 2000s event, finally, and it's not really a good thing because it's kind of like backhanded at the same time, but Stephen Harper, the prime minister at the time, he had gave an apology, and he agreed to compensate First Nations people, all the residential school survivors, to be compensated. And I think that's where that term really came from, because you know, residential schools had shut down in the 50s, 70s, and then the last one closing in the 90s. And, you know, First Nations people were just kind of left in like the rubble of it all. And for generations, like, there's so much trauma since colonialism to Canada, or to this continent. And yeah, like in my own personal experience, like my late mom, she was in residential school at a young age, along with most of her siblings. I have many aunts and uncles who were also in residential school, grandparents, and part of that, like, there's so many different experiences from them, but for me, it was really a lack of culture. There was lots of addiction, alcoholism. There's lots of violence, trauma. Like, what residential schools, the biggest harm they did was separate families, separate the children, and, you know, strip them of First Nations identity, and to shame them to shame them for who they were, basically. And on my mom's side, our community's very, very like that. Like they don't talk about culture really, or maybe now it's a little bit more accepted, but when I was younger, like nobody talks about culture. It's evil, ceremony's evil, and all this and that. It's very Catholic, and people are very strict. And my mom, when she was younger, she was super rebellious, so she became sort of like a black sheep of the family. And like she's not here to tell her own story, but how I see it is like just all these effects of colonialism and the residential schools and where it brought maybe my late mom to choose the path that she did. And she was an addict for many years. She didn't have children till she was 30. And as soon as she had my older sister and then me following her, my mom really tried to change her life. And but I remember like there was still a lot of hardship, like when I was 4 years old, witnessing a lot of violence, witnessing my mom being beaten, and like police involvement. I was apprehended. I was also sexually abused, and just all these things. And then my mom had finally got sober. She went to treatment and rehab, and we went back home to our community for a few months, I remember. And then following that, we moved to a small town in Saskatchewan, and my mom just turned to Christianity so hard, and she put all of us into Christian school, private school. And like I didn't find out like nothing. I knew nothing about my culture, who I was as a Cree person or a Dene person, or what even residential schools were, or like what colonialism is, or like all these things I didn't find out till I was actually in grade 12. And that's finally when I went to like public school and took my first Native Studies course. And I was like, it was just such like this huge eye opener for me, because I didn't know all along. Like I was dealing with all these traumas, and even when I did come like a certain age, me too, I chose the wrong path right away. Like I turned to alcohol. I turned to addiction, like drug use, hard drug use, and I was in a lot of crime involvement, like doing petty crime and eventually getting arrested. And I did overdose at one time, and dropping out of school and not being able to hold a job, and eventually ending up on the streets and everything like that. It was pretty rough. And now that I'm sober and in university, I really see what intergenerational trauma is, specifically for like First Nations people, and that we have to deal with all these adversities, and they're almost at like an epidemic rate. Some people, like most people that I find, we turn to addiction, and then there are those who commit suicide, or they're just, it's just really, really tough, I guess. And yeah, that's kind of how I understand intergenerational trauma stemming from residential schools, and then even before that.
Yeah. It seems all this trauma that, even our generations before us have went through, the residential schools, the colonialism that happened, the epidemics that happened, like smallpox that wiped away whole families even. It's how I was talking to you before, where I said it's all like it was hushed, you can't talk about that kind of stuff. You can't bring up that kind of stuff, And when you said that you didn't even know about it, that's so true. It should be like taught in schools, how all this colonialism, residential schools, families being torn apart, all the wrongs, they should be they should be taught, because, you know, just like you, they didn't teach that in schools where, you know, in where Bethel, where I'm from, you know.
Yeah.
If they did, it was just a mention only, you know.
Yeah, or they didn't really go into depth. Like, even at that, when I was in grade 12 and I took my first Native Studies course, it wasn't really in depth. It was just a surface until I got to university and really went in depth of colonial history and then history before colonialism and stuff like that. But it's such an eye-opener, like, just to become aware of history and First Nations issues and why things are the way they are. Like, it was really life-changing for me, because since then, like, kind of like my eyes were open, and I was aware of more than what I had known all my life, and I really wanted things to change.
Mm-hmm. Do you think if you had that information before, it would have been easier for you not to take the path that you did?
Yeah, I think so, because when I ended up at my rock bottom, I was so devastated. And the reason why is because I didn't know why I ended up where I ended up, just on the streets and so young. I didn't understand why my life was the way it was. I had no understanding, and it was so devastating to me. Like, why me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of people experience that, and a lot of people don't know about this, the past, you know, how everything is basically just stuffed in until you make the wrong decisions, or you learn to cope with them in an unhealthy way, like, you know, drinking and letting it all out, and, you know, just that itself is just us trying to cope with something that is within all of us, I think,
mm-hmm.
in unhealthy ways. But if we learn that intergenerational trauma and trauma itself, even in your generation, and ways to deal with it and ways to talk about it, open up maybe in a safe place, you know, to somebody who is, you know, a safe person, even, you know,
mm-hmm.
it really starts to open up the healing process, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Being able to open up, I guess that kind of goes into the topic of better coping mechanisms, mental health, and choosing, making better choices, and just stuff like that. Kind of like what I'm doing with my life now, I feel like.
Yeah, and you said you didn't have any really anything to do with your culture, but now you're becoming a Cree language teacher.
Instructor, language instructor.
So cool.
Yeah, for real. Like, at the U of A, what I'm taking is a combined degree for Native Studies and Education. And I'm going the secondary route, so that's high school level. And my major is the Cree language. My minor is art, but more specifically Indigenous arts and crafts. And what I actually want to do is, when I'm done both degrees, I was thinking maybe I should go for my master's and then apprentice under the Cree language instructor at the U of A, so that I could teach at the U of A. That's what I want to do. I feel like I could definitely work with high school, like young adults, but I feel more drawn to like a university environment. And
Heck yeah, man, go for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my algorithms are Indigenous and you know, like recovery and sobriety, stuff like that. So it's really amazing. That's where I get a lot of my guests. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I see somebody posting and I'm like, hey, that's cool. I should get him on there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So When you were decided to get sober, what inspired you?
Well, like I said, I hit a rock bottom, and I was looking around. I remember the exact moment. I was stranded here in Edmonton. I didn't live here at the time, and I went to the library, and I was looking out the window, waiting to get on the computer to maybe ask for some help from somebody on social media. But I was sitting at the library and waiting, and I was looking out the window, and I was watching all these people walk by, and some of them had on like warm winter coats because it was snowing at the time. Some of them had coffee in hand or their kids, and they just looked so normal to me, and I didn't understand why I couldn't have that. And that's when I felt so devastated, and I actually prayed for the first time. And what inspired me to continue to really strive for sobriety and to say I need help because I was struggling, to say I need help, was I ended up at my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting the following day, and it was at Palmaker's Treatment Lodge. And I sat right at the very front row, and I was listening to all these speakers. And then this Native man came up, and he started sharing his story about living on the res and how life was when he was a kid and how he struggled with alcohol and drug use and all the mistakes he made, and kind of like what I was feeling like. And then he started to share his sobriety and his recovery and what his life was like and all these cool things he's doing in his life. And then I think he shared he had like 30 some years of sobriety. And I was like, what? I was like, wow, like that man really inspired me. 'Cause suddenly I seen a Native person with a similar story as mine. Mm-hmm. And then him, his life changing, he shared that, and what his life was like now. And I was like, that's the life I want. And you could tell too, he was really connected to culture. He had long braided hair. He had all kinds of beadwork on, and he had his Native accent, and he was speaking Cree here and there sometimes. And I was like, this guy is really cool. Like, that's what I want in the future. And yeah, that's what inspired me. I just kept going for it, stumbled here and there, but eventually found my footing, and I just kept doing it.
Well, Roberta, I want to thank you so much.
Yes, thank you too. Thank you.
Well, that's all for today's show. I hope you, the listeners, found some inspiration, strength, and hope. Listen next week when I have another strong, courageous person on who's walking with us on this healing journey. This program is available as a podcast. You can hear this and many more episodes wherever you listen to podcasts or at anonymouseskimo.com. Join in the Anonymous Eskimo Project, Saturdays at 3 p.m., Sundays at 8 p.m. on KSKO, serving the western interior of Alaska for more than four decades. I'm your host, Ralph Sara. Biura!
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.